Good morning, Oregon. Thank you once again for loading me down and queuing me up. I'm Finn J.D. John, bringing you another daily episode of the Offbeat Oregon History Audio Edition podcast, which every weekday brings you another story from the archives of the Offbeat Oregon History syndicated newspaper column. Full details are at offbeatoregon.com. You can check that out at your leisure. But right now, I'd like to tell you a story about Camp Adair, which was Oregon's second largest city when it was built. It was built in 6 months. And it lasted just 6 years before it was turned by the order of the U.S. government into a ghost town and cut up for salvage. You will sometimes hear Vanport cited as Oregon's second largest city, and that may be true. I doubt it, but it might. Vanport and Camp Adair shared several things in common. One is that they were associated with World War II. Two is that they were never subject to an actual census count, so we don't really know. And three is that they both were roughly 40,000 people. So while I suspect that Camp Adair was probably the larger of the two, I really don't know, and neither does anyone else. But in the final analysis, it's probably a moot point, because neither one of these things was really a city. Well, this article was first published on April 24th, 2010. Here it is. In 1942, Oregon's second largest city sprang into being. In 6 months, a big patch of the Mid-Willamette Valley became a massive army training camp. Camp Adair. It was better known as Swamp Adair, and in fact, ironically enough, you may not be able to hear this, but right outside the recording studio, there's a large frog croaking. I just had to point that out because it's very apropos for a story about Camp Adair. It's been raining for a little while now. Well, 6 months after it was built, Camp Adair was the state's biggest salvage operation, and today it's the state's biggest ghost town. Well, here's the story, the short version anyway. If you want the long version, you'll have to buy John Baker's book, which I definitely recommend. In about 1940, people in Washington, D.C. pretty much knew war was coming and started looking around for a 65,000-acre piece of ground, mostly nice and flat with some woody, hilly terrain on it, a place that would seem like a little piece of Germany where they expected to be doing the fighting. By 1941, it was down to two sites, one near Eugene, and one just north of Corvallis. Business leaders in Corvallis and Monmouth, with an eye on the retail trade, actually visited Washington, D.C. to lobby for the more northerly site, to the dismay of about 750 people living in the area around and in the tiny town of Wells, who were subsequently displaced by the base. They were successful. Many had to leave crops in the ground and were not compensated for them, although the government did pay for their land. But there were few complaints. After all, there was a war on by this time. And a few weeks later, Wells was razed and the area was, as they say today, shovel ready. Then the crews moved in, four big construction companies that during peacetime were fierce regional competitors. During the construction season of 1942, mid-spring to late fall, they built about 1,800 buildings. According to historian John H. Baker, the author of the book that I just mentioned, these included, quote, a field house with three full-size basketball courts, a bakery which had a capacity to produce 45,000 loaves of bread every day, a wastewater treatment plant, a freshwater treatment plant, a heating plant, 500 barracks, 11 chapels, 5 movie theaters, 13 post exchanges, 2 service clubs, a hospital, a bank, a post office, phone exchanges, warehouses, coal yards, headquarters building, a gas house, firing ranges, a model German village, electrical substation and service, airfield, day and orderly rooms, rail yards, and the major improvements of Highway 99W. All this in 6 months. To do this, 8,000 people worked all summer. At their peak, they were finishing a building every 32 minutes. Electricians learned to wear stilts to save the time it usually took to move a ladder around. The hospital, Baker writes, broke a national record for construction speed, and it was all done, on time, under budget. By mid-September, the instant city was ready to welcome its 40,000 non-inhabitants. This at a time when Salem had just 31,000 residents and Eugene about 20,000. Portland at 305,000 was the runaway leader in population. Units trained at Adair for service in the war included the 91st Infantry Powder River Division, the 70th Infantry Trailblazers Division, the 104th Infantry Timberwolf Division, and the 96th Infantry Deadeye Division. The camp was decommissioned after the war, though little bits of it lingered on into the 1960s, including an array of anti-aircraft missiles installed in 59. Buildings were dismantled in panels and trucked away or floated across the Willamette River to be used to build new homes. Hundreds of these, characterized by sash windows of uniform size and 2-inch thick exterior walls, still shelter families all over the Mid-Valley today, although many have been upgraded to give them better insulation. Today, the northeastern corner of Camp Adair is a wildlife refuge, the E.E. Wilson. It's been restored to the seasonal wetland that it once was, so mosquitoes are not unknown there, although, thanks to plentiful bug-eating wildlife, not as common as you might expect. The long, straight, broad stretches of abandoned blacktop make for a pleasant bicycling spot, and the plentiful ruins and foundation walls are great for geocaching. It's an especially rewarding place to visit with a copy of Baker's book to use as a sort of ghost town guide. Nearby, the city of Adair Village, incorporated in the 1970s on a corner of the old site, still has several of the original buildings, including the camp's old fire station, which is now a restaurant. That's the end of the article, but I've got a personal note I wanted to add to this one. I actually live in a house that was built in the early 1950s out of salvaged material from Camp Adair. Before we moved in, I gutted the old house and retrofitted it with stud walls, but the construction of this house was really interesting. Each panel was built by laying out tongue and groove 1x4 planks on a flat surface, probably a concrete floor, and then laying an X-shaped pattern of bracing 1x4s on top of that and nailing it together with ribbon nails. Then, 3/4-inch sheetrock, Kaiser brand actually, was attached to that, and voila! Wallboard, stud wall, sheathing, siding, all in one neat little 2-inch thick package. Of course, its insulation value was pretty close to that of a tent wall. And the walls really did look weird. There were no windowsills in the house. The walls also carry the load of the roof all by themselves, which is a system that I've heard called structural sheathing. And in our case, the weight of the whole house was transferred to the mud sills on the foundation wall by nothing more than a row of nails. So it was a little bit scary. I'm surprised that the whole thing hadn't kind of slumped down before we bought it. Also, the floor was not a structural part of the house. In fact, I ripped the whole thing out, including beams and girders, and for a little while, our home was nothing but a 60-year-old shell nailed to the mud sill of the foundation wall with a dirt floor. We didn't live in it at the time, but that's what it looked like. Well, those Camp Adair houses, they weren't pretty, but they worked, and our place is a lot nicer now that I've actually fitted stud walls up behind the shell and insulated everything. That's pretty much all I've got for you for today. And if you're listening for the first time, or if you just generally want more info about Offbeat Oregon history, everything's there at our central website at offbeatoregon.com. There's a complete catalog of about 200 columns going back to 2008, and there's links out to audio and text feeds on RSS and iTunes so that you can sign up to have this stuff delivered straight to your iPhone or iPad or Android or whatever you drive, and of course the Facebook page and Twitter feed. The website's also where you'll find the full citations to sources for this story, which of course includes Baker's book, and in addition to the Benton County Historical Museum and the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife Visitor's Guide and the City of Adair Village's website. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band, atlasstringband.com, and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Coming to Corvallis, drop me a line. Let's grab a cup of coffee and talk history. I'm at finn@offbeatoregon.com, or if you do Twitter, @offbeatoregon. By the way, if you've emailed me and I haven't responded, please email me again. Stuff tends to get buried in my email queue. I really need a better management system for that. This podcast is covered under Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike license. For details of that, see offbeatoregon.com/cc. But that's it for today. Coming up tomorrow is Thursday, and I'm going to be doing a reading. That's part two of the lost chapter of my book, Wicked Portland, The Wild and Lusty Underworld of a Frontier Seaport Town, telling how the story of the temperance riots in downtown Portland in 1874, how they kind of wrapped up. This will be the full story of the War of the Webfoot Saloon, in which a half-crazy saloon owner squared off with a large group of hymn-singing, prayer-praying Victorian ladies in their Sunday best. One side was fighting with prayers and songs, the other side was fighting with firecrackers and water hoses and gong beaters and just all kinds of rude stuff. And you'll never guess who won. Or maybe you will. Anyway, I'll have that for you after about 6 o'clock tomorrow morning. And in the meantime, go out and fill up the rest of today with good stuff. Bye now.